Hello and welcome to this Lotus Eaters interview. I'm Harry, joined today by returning guest Henry Martin, otherwise known as Reactionary Reading Lore. Thank you very much for coming into the studio. It's a pleasure to have you again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And if you're wondering what this discussion is going to be about, last time Henry came in was to speak about his book published through Imperium Press. Would you like to remind the audience of that?
Yes, it's a book called Political Lawfare, Practical Approaches, and it discusses the topic of political lawfare in an academic sense and how it can be best used as a means of achieving political goals. And it's a UK-US comparison, which if you read the first chapter, why I chose that model will come clear.
Yes, it's a very interesting book, very useful for anybody who's interested in that subject and wants to have a greater depth of knowledge on it. You also on Substack, and which your book's available on Amazon and other retailers.
Yes.
You've got your Substack, Reactionary Reading Lore.
Yes.
So you can find him there. But the last discussion that we had was about your book, but also it was back in December. We were speaking about Restore Britain and the developments that had been going on with that when it was still a political movement, more of a pressure group, would you agree?
Yes.
And we'd been discussing about the future of where we thought it was going, and I thought we'd get a nice catch-up today. Because since then, obviously, there's been a lot of developments. They've become a political party as of February. They have contested a number of elections, Makerfield, the Greater Manchester mayoral election most recently. And looking through your Substack and listening to some of the streams that you've been doing on some of the policy papers, I know that you have a number of pertinent criticisms, which I think are very useful for people to hear so that we can know where we're going with this and what we can do to improve the situation going forwards and make meaningful political change or improve our chances of making meaningful political change. So it would be good to have that discussion with you now because you've got a good mind for this stuff.
Yeah, it's especially with my interest has changed because I've basically written, as far as I can tell, everything that I think I can on things like political lawfare and legal and political strategy. And I've moved towards reviewing policy and talking about policy and other approaches for legal people and government in a more academic way, and I do some of that stuff behind the scenes. And when I started my Substack nearly 5 years ago, there wasn't really any either anonymous or public right-wing or whatever that even means now. You could say nativist, you could say conservative lawyers who are openly would talk about such matters and other legal academics. So whereas now there has been, it's got a long way to go, but a little bit of a blogosphere that has been set up and been created by people who are either interested in law because of a legal academic or a practicing lawyer, like Michael Rayners, for example. I reviewed one of his suggestions or draft bills.
This was the most recent upload onto your Substack, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. He had something which he called the Oblivion Act 2026, which was a draft bill that would require that legislation from, I believe, 1920 or thereabouts be justified by the government departments or as set out in the legislation, it would be gotten rid of.
Mm.
In terms of my review of that, I think it's an interesting idea. I'm a bit more conservative in terms of getting rid of primary and secondary legislation because as someone who has focused an area of interest is business law and regulations and that type of thing, I'm especially for things like energy and industry, most regulations and legislation around that exists for a reason.
Mm.
And yes, there is stuff that you can get rid of and would improve the economy and the profitability of those interests as well, those industries, it's not something that should be done quickly. And my approach to repealing legislation is that any government who wants to enact their own agenda, if it doesn't comply with the post-Blairite paradigm, is going to have to, before they go into government, have a pretty substantial list of legislation they want to get rid of or amend so that they can, over the next 5 years, enact their agenda. This has been recognised by the likes of Dr. David Starkey, and is the term Great Repeal Act is thrown
something
around a lot.
Something relevant to Restore Britain, something that we'll get onto later with some of the policy papers that they've been putting forward. Certainly something that Harrison Pitt has suggested as well in reference to David Starkey, that there needs to be the Great Repeal of a lot of legislation, which does seem to be a bias amongst people on the right and centre-right conservative sphere to kind of want to just wash away any and all legislation that they're aware of that they think will impede them.
In terms of the Great Repeal Act, I wrote a review about a year or so ago on my Substack on the thought of it and what wanted to put my own sort of Blairite legislation in and what I would get rid of, because there doesn't exist, as far as I'm aware, certainly not from David Starkey or Harrison Pitt or basically anyone else, a draft copy of the Great Repeal Act. It's just something that seems to exist as a sort of sentiment and not something that exists in reality. And I think that's why Michael Reynolds did his Oblivion Act, because it was him trying to enact something like that in his way of doing it, which I applaud him for, because more of that type of thing needs doing.
Yeah, taking it out of the abstract and into reality.
Yes.
Putting it down on paper. And the difficulty with that is when you start to do that, there may be flaws, there may be issues with what you put down, but at the very least, it's good to get started on this. And this is one thing that I always find a little bit frustrating, is that so often people will talk about doing something and nobody will ever actually do it, and it will only remain in the realm of online conversation. We should do this. Nobody does anything.
I think that's a mixture of laziness or being unable to do certain things, but also there is a reluctance to try things.
Which is relevant as well, to get another quick plug in, for your article, which is in the latest Islander 6, titled Influence is Not Power, which is one of my favourite articles from it, actually. You bring up a number of very, very relevant criticisms and pointers for where the right goes wrong through its social media activism lens, and some of your issues that I share with you about the fact that a lot of people on the right, again, they either are charlatans attracting influence and attracting patronage, or the people who are offering the patronage are not looking for our ends either.
Yeah, you get multiple extremes of that. You get people who are just have got a bit of money and want to be high status in a particular circle for whatever reasons. And then you get people who are actively putting money into things so that it's wasted and nothing can actually get done. Because over the past few years, the amount of projects that I've seen either go nowhere because there's no funding available for them, or money, in some cases quite substantial amounts of money, has been allocated to projects that don't go anywhere because the people they're giving money to are idiots.
I've seen it happen myself a number of times. I'm sure we've both seen some of the same ones it's happened to. Moving on to Restore and your criticisms of them. First, I would like to just get your views since our last discussion, seeing as it's where we ended off. When they were a political pressure group, I think we both agreed at the end of the discussion that we thought it was better at the time that they remain a political pressure group, which of course came undone about 2 months later when they converted into a political party. What do you think about that initial decision? What are your thoughts on the motivations of it and the potential of it. What did you think at the time?
Right. I was against it being a political party from the start. I'll try and be as diplomatic as possible. Restore, as I criticised, when it was a pressure group, the available policy wing and the organisation of it was, in my opinion, lacking. So when they set themselves up as a political party, they were quite obviously and quite visibly overwhelmed by tens of thousands of people wanting to get involved in Restore. And there was a time after Rupert Lowe's excellent video on the farm, which I liked.
I think it was still a very effective video, still quite inspiring.
Yes. They ended up having, as far as I can tell, from what I saw as an outsider, but also knowing some of the insiders and what I was getting told, was they can't do it. They can't catch up because they were completely unprepared for processing that many people. And I think what should have happened, in my opinion, before they even thought about registering as a party, was had some locals events, because before they started as a political party, they had roughly 20,000 members. And what they should have done, in my opinion, was got people to volunteer as regional organisers and built something of a network, both in localities and also in terms of people who are solid who could organise stuff, so that Restore can draw upon its members when it was a pressure group to get involved and help with whatever.
What would that have been towards the end of?
Well, so it was quite obvious that there was no ability to process people and answer emails. I'm sure if Restore had planned this, they probably could have gotten a load of people on a freelance basis or whatever, whether on volunteers, probably not volunteers, and planned out so they had an admin team ready to process the influx of memberships that, let's be honest, I'd say it was quite obvious it was going to happen because that's what they were planning for. They were planning for that video to get as much reach as possible and increase membership. And it was concerning for me for them being a government in waiting, not being able to organise the basics of that.
Are these not just sort of the normal kind of growing pains that you would expect to experience with any fledgling party?
Yes and no. I think it's, if it's a fledgling party that wasn't as popular as Restore, it wouldn't have been an issue. But if it was just that, I wouldn't have the concerns that I do. But there does seem to be a huge organisational problem with Restore and its ability to run its day-to-day operations, whether that be campaigning or policy. And it just seems that everyone is, because it's such a small team, everyone's inundated with work and there's no real focus on what people are meant to be doing. So it ends up with a team of people who, as far as I can tell, are good, well-meaning, clever people, but because they don't really have experience running organisations, they're not able to preempt some of the problems that they've encountered and work from there. For example, one of the things that I think, since we're on what I think Restore should have done, is they should have built a network of people who are on side, so they're not as isolated, who could help with things like policy or administration or whatever, because having that network of people who can be organised for other things that aren't just doing leaflets is a really powerful thing. If you've got a pressure group with 20,000 members and you've got 200 of them who can be relied upon to take part in activities, whether that's campaigns or whether that's helping out with administration, organising events or local outreach. Quite a lot of organisations would kill for that, especially organisations that are pressure groups and political parties. Their in real life engagement is quite low. When I was at university, I went to the Student Labour Party or saw an event, and there was 5 people there. A Restore meeting has, judging by the photos, anywhere from 50 to 100 of people who want to show up and want to do something. In general, I don't think enough was done to preempt that and be able to deal with that.
So it's a little bit of a case of too much too fast.
Yes.
So, and obviously you've said that they could have prepared for that a little bit better, and they would have inundated it and made sure that they had infrastructure organisations already set up before they did this, or at least nodes of organisation already set up to be able to handle all of this. But given where we are now and how popular they were, what do you think the central attraction for people has been and continues to be for people who have joined Restore, especially those who've jumped over from Reform to Restore?
I think part of it is that Reform is, it's not doing what it's set out to be. It's not being the nativist party. So there has always been a space since the 1950s, and if not before, for a nativist party, because, and it's got the need for an openly nativist party has grown and grown and grown, because as the demographics of Britain change,
as it accelerates as well.
Yes, the decline in the British population and the massive increase in foreign-born migrants and communities, not having a party that will represent the interests of British people. And I think BLM did quite a lot as well, because people my age aren't really able to think in a way that isn't ethnic or racial, because you were growing up listening to, and in some cases being taught, critical race theory. And the events of BLM in the 2020 certainly made most people ethnically conscious in a way that they hadn't been previously, because, and able to articulate that, because there's quite a lot of evidence that British or English people specifically, and to a lesser extent Northwestern Europeans, are considerably less ethnically conscious than other groups of people. It's why the I is capitalised, we're more individual. And in England especially, it's not really true for places like Ireland and other parts of Europe. England has English people haven't really had to live in communities that are close to other ethnic communities, whereas in the Middle East, for example, in China, or even places like Japan as well, those groups throughout their history have been...
There's strong tribal divisions,
yes,
which creates stronger ties.
Ethnic ties.
England is quite a remarkable country in how early we were unified as a people, as opposed to remaining separate warring tribes, with the bringing together of the kingdoms into the English nation, and then further centralization and unification under William the Conqueror. Terrible things he did to do so, but it did end up unifying all of us under the crown. And we've had a much longer gestation period than lots of different other peoples as a broader but unified group, where, you know, the town next over is not conceived of as, oh, that's a completely separate tribe and nation of people. No, they're Englishmen like you or I. Whereas now, since 1948, really, in the Windrush generation, the influx of mass migration, you are right that it's massively accelerated and changed the way that people are seeing that. Whereas before, they were like, my next door neighbor is just like me. He's anybody, and I should treat him fairly. They're getting people moving in next door who are not like them, and certainly do not want to be friends with them and do not share a culture or meaningful relationship or history with them. And they can see their quality of life going downhill as a result of that. So the appeal being that it seems like a party that is willing to represent the natives.
Yes, it is. And also, I know for people like me who are quite business interested, though Rupert Lowe has been criticised for his Thatcherism,
mm-hmm.
I like his enterprising spirit, even though I'm not a huge fan of how much he talks about being a Thatcherite and Ayn Rand, for example. I think that a lot of free market economics and deregulation sides of the argument is a joke and hasn't really adapted seriously to the way that technology economies have developed, because there's something that Rupert Lowe is often saying, that you can't regulate for growth. And that's, as a universal statement, that can be questioned quite convincingly by many investors, academic institutions, for example, because a lot of industries, especially industries such as energy, such as infrastructure, such as construction, such as medicine, for example, investing in those industries is very difficult if you don't have a stable regulatory framework, because especially if you're an outside investor, because if you can invest in, I don't know, a plant to manufacture medication, whatever kind of medication it is, in England we have, I know some people disagree with me on this, especially post-COVID, quite a well-regulated system. There are problems with it, I'm sure. But for an investor and for all parties involved, it's best that those industries are regulated fairly in a way that isn't overly burdensome, but also is done for health and safety and also the stability of investments. Because if you've got sensible regulation that's stable, that will likely mean that your investments in industries are more stable and likely to be more safe because it's a well-regulated industry. Whereas if it's not well-regulated, if it's legal highs, for example, I wouldn't invest in legal highs. It wasn't regulated at all.
Mm.
And then because they were so bad for people's health. So when I say legal highs,
I know what you're talking about, and I've seen a number of people who've done them, and they were certainly not good for you. But
no.
add some context for the audience.
So legal highs used to be a thing about 10 years ago. I think it's a bit longer, but
they're still around at that time. Yeah,
they got banned because these were being promoted to people as fun recreational drugs that weren't illegal. And they were suggested to be safe, but within the space of a year or two, they proved to be quite dangerous for people, and they were just banned. So to give an example of something that was formerly a legal high, something like spice.
I was going to ask if spice was included among the legal highs, because that's quite a notorious one
now. Yeah, as far as I'm aware, yes. But the point I'm making is that if you don't have an industry that is well and sensibly regulated, I know it's an extreme example that I just used, but a lot of the problems that wise regulators could have foreseen and taken steps to mitigate will happen. And when that happens, you'll likely create an excessively regulated environment, which doesn't work really for anyone apart from bureaucrats.
Hmm. But despite all of your criticisms of his statement on regulation, you have appreciated his enterprising spirit.
Yes, I love it.
Yeah. Because he is still quite a charismatic figure. He does play to the camera quite well sometimes, despite some of the gaffes that he's been criticised for over the past 6 months. I think that's a case of recognising that he is not some extreme radical. Mm. He is an older gentleman who does have, old-fashioned neoliberal Thatcherite style economic views and views on individualism and integration and such like that, which did not come as too much of a surprise for me, but did seem to be in somewhat of a disparity between the way that certain people, I'd even include people on this podcast, I can't remember every statement that I've ever made about Rupert Lowe, perhaps even myself. I'm happy to criticize things that I've said in the past, there was a disparity between the way that he was being sold and the actual vision of the real man. And I think that's not actually, it's not actually really Rupert's fault that people were selling him as some kind of like extreme political radical when he's actually much more moderate than that. Yes. Either way, the party seemed to be an interesting vehicle for nativists and seemed to be an interesting vehicle to get the political outcomes that they want. Do you see, in our current climate, before we get on to some of your greater criticisms, do you see any better alternatives than Restore at the moment, or are they still the best bet for aspiring patriots?
Not really, outside of things, niche parties like the Homeland Party and...
Are they still around?
I don't know if they are.
Yeah, well, nobody's heard about them for a long
who's
while.
Who's the guy who's running for against Nigel Farage in Clacton?
Oh, Kai.
Yeah, he's
Kai,
like,
and he's part of the British Democrats Party, I think, is their name.
He's an openly nationalist. I suppose if you want nativism, you could probably support them, but are they going to get anywhere? Probably not. Because small organisations that are unlikely to get anywhere as political parties, I think that being a political party and standing for election is just a waste of time. Because unless it's like some local initiative to take over the council to achieve a desired outcome, whether that's stops your local council wasting money, it's not really worth doing to get money off people when you've got 100 members paying and just standing in elections that you're not going to win.
So what I've learned there is that we have said no to the National Rebirth Party.
I haven't heard of this. What is
have
it?
You? Well, there you go. That's I'll leave that at that. So for the time being, Restore for aspiring nationalists and patriots still seems to be a better vehicle than most of for electoral and other political pressure from what we're seeing, but. Now on to some of the criticisms that you have had of them, and this is related to an article that you have written. I think you also appeared on a stream, was it with Blamblas?
Yes.
Discussing the rape gang inquiry report. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying that we understand that this is a very emotive subject. This is not to denigrate in any way the experiences of the victims who gave testimony or anything like that. Your criticisms of this are a criticism of the way the report was structured and the way that it was written and some of the things that have been said about potential safeguarding issues as
yes.
well that have been raised, unverified still for the time being, I believe, though.
Yes. So there's been some concerns about safeguarding and by that Donna Rachel woman.
Donna Rachel. Now, just to remind people, she was the woman who had a very, shall we say, poorly thought out video in response to it, where she came across as a little bit more jovial and smug than she should have in
yes.
raising the criticisms. She started off the thing laughing, and I know that she was laughing at what she saw as the poor quality of the report, but a lot of people saw it as being very dismissive of the testimonies that were held within it. Either way, she was ruthlessly attacked for that and locked her account for a long while on social media. Despite that, and despite the way that she conveyed the message, was there legitimacy to her actual criticisms?
Right, so one of her main criticisms was that there wasn't a proper methodology and there wasn't a clear plan of what the inquiry would entail and what its research questions were or its inquiry questions were. And that, from reading the report, as far as I can see, that's a fair criticism. She's also made the safeguarding concerns that you alluded to just a minute ago, which are that some of the people who had given testimony had been traumatised because of the process and there wasn't adequate safeguarding involved. I should add as some context to this, from the video that she posted, which I think was on the 17th of June.
I couldn't give you the exact date, sorry.
Yes, either or, I've got it in my notes, but it doesn't really matter. She went on to explain that she was initially consulted about the inquiry by Alistair Harrison, who I believe is Rupert Lowe's chief of staff. And her reasoning, she wanted to like direct, and because she runs a victims group, support group for victims of grooming, she wanted to try and make sure that this was done properly, as she saw it, with the necessary professionals and the right methodology and safeguarding. What she said was, in that video, that the reason she stopped being involved was because that Alistair Harrison didn't have an adequate safeguarding plan and wasn't amenable to creating an adequate safeguarding plan. This was disputed by other people on Twitter, I can't remember exactly who, but it was argued that the reason she in fact chose not to be involved with the inquiry was that they wouldn't pay her for her involvement.
Yeah, so I was going to bring that up. A lot of people were instead suggesting that because she wasn't getting either paid for it or the right amount of money that she thought was adequate for her services as part of this, a lot of accusations were being made of her being sort of money grubbing, and she was only in it for the money, looking to take advantage of people who had been victims of the grooming gang so that she could profit off of it. Now, would you say that those were fair criticisms, or would you say that that was unreasonable given the level of work that needs to be involved in these processes?
I would say those are unreasonable criticisms, because I'll tie into the lawyer who was involved in this, and power to him to doing the report for free.
It was pro bono.
He did it for free. He was involved in the inquiry and he did that for free. That's power to him. That was a very good thing for him to do.
Clearly very personally motivated to do something like that.
Yes. However, when I looked up his CV, Graham Smith is his name, it seems that his area of expertise isn't in inquiry type work, it's commercial sports law and trusts, which it's quite a different skill set.
Mm.
So normally the type of people who would run an independent inquiry of that nature would be specialists at doing that. And I think because they weren't willing to pay someone to do it, or that's what it seemed to be, some of the problems did occur whereby that these issues with the report that we're going to go into were present. Whereas if they'd have paid someone whose expertise and their day-to-day is engaging in these type of inquiries, they probably would have got a much better report in terms of and inquiry.
Just to clarify, so obviously, you're criticising his area of expertise not potentially being the one that's relevant or adequate for the work that he's being asked for. What kind of qualifications, expertise do you hold?
I'm anonymous. I'm not answering that question, because I can be right without being an expert in political, without being an expert in doing these type of inquiries.
Just asking to clarify for the audience.
Yes.
That's okay.
I wasn't criticising his expertise. I was just making the point that his area of expertise, from the available information I was able to find on the internet, from his CV that is available, it's not like this. That's not his usual line of work. He's doing it as a volunteer, which power to him for doing, but because of some of the issues that the report has had, which we'll go into soon, I don't think that if they'd have paid someone whose expertise is doing public inquiries or private inquiries of this kind, that the problems with the report that we'll go into would have been present. I wasn't trying to criticise his expertise. All I'm saying is it is relevant.
No, of course. I know, I just wanted to, because I would imagine the audience would be wanting to just clarify that, but that's absolutely fine. We'll move past that. So when we talk about the problems that this has caused within the paper itself, What problems would you draw attention to?
Right. So I'll start with some of the criticisms that a guy called Adam Wren made when he was writing for Unheard. And one of the criticisms that he has made and others was the 250,000 number. Mm. And his point was essentially that the number wasn't really that accurate. It was quite flawed in terms of it being an estimate. The criticism that he has also made, and Connor Tomlinson also discussed this on his podcast live stream, was that especially the account of someone called Katie, whether that's the real name or not, was quite difficult to believe, and it may have been the result of some people with traumatic experiences are also prone to making things up as a coping mechanism.
Was Katie the one who discussed the dog?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, because that was one of the more shocking statements that had come out of it.
Yes. And I do agree with Adam Wren's criticism there that I'm just not sure that enough was done to verify these accounts and make sure that you didn't get accounts of people who may have had something awful happen to them, but may also be unable to distinguish between fact and fiction.
I mean, within the paper itself, was there any sort of explanation of what was done to verify these accounts, the methodology for them?
No.
Would that be normal for a paper like this to give some explanation of methodology for
it? Yes.
Okay, so that's a shortcoming there.
That's a shortcoming. And in terms of other sort of academic shortcomings that were present in the report was, I'll get to this now, other than the testimonies of the alleged victims, or in some cases genuine victims because of prosecutions, because some of them are verifiably victims, their abusers have rightly been put in prison where they belong. But other than that, the report doesn't really make any new findings that weren't already available to the public through previous government inquiries or the work of other people.
I mean, this was something that crossed my mind when it first came out, was I was wondering, other than the just explicit details of the testimony, which as tragic and relevant and necessary to know as some of it is, also seemed to be a case where people were using it to almost generate engagement on social media through spectacle, look at the shocking, lurid detail that I'm sharing. I asked, outside of some of the specific testimony, what new information are we gathering from this? I know there were certain accusations made about the role of somebody like Andy Burnham in potentially covering it up, but what further investigations were able to be done off of the back of some of those allegations, the 250,000 figure, while I don't think it's anywhere near out of the realm of
possibility
at all, is essentially an oft-repeated figure from, what, 2019? From the House of Lords, when one of the Lords made an off-the-top-of-the-head kind of estimate, kind of just going off, well, if this many happened in Rochdale and we extrapolate that out to the rest of the country, then the ballpark would be 250,000, which isn't an actual scientific or sociological methodology for any of this.
Considering that £600,000 were raised for this report, I expected a lot more, and that repeating that 250,000 number without doing any further research, I wasn't very impressed with. And I would be very interested to know, actually, where that £600,000 was spent.
Well, wasn't £600,000 also for the inquiry itself?
Yes, it was the inquiry itself. But I think that given the quality of the report and the inquiry, I'm not saying there has been anything in terms of inappropriate.
You're not alleging corruption.
No,
or
not at all.
Or anything like that. No.
I just think that some transparency as to where the £600,000 went, how much is left over, because Rupert and others from Restore have said that they're going to do everything they can to seek private prosecutions for the grooming gang victims or alleged victims. And I hope that happens. I would probably suggest that someone called Robin Tilbrook is better qualified to organise that type of thing, because he himself has, as far as I'm aware, pro bono represented these victims of this type of abuse and sought civil claims against their abusers and won some quite amazing damages, actually, in terms of like hundreds of thousands of pounds for these victims.
So he's someone that you would recommend if any of the if anybody involved in Restore is watching this.
Yes.
He is somebody that you should look into if you're not already in contact with him to try and go forward with was it private prosecutions?
Private prosecutions and seeking compensation for victims, because he's got experience doing that.
Yeah, because there still can be limited. Obviously, it's not statutory, so they're not unable to force people to give evidence or testimony or anything.
Yes.
But there can still be limited but positive outcomes result from the back of this, despite the sort of criticisms that we're putting forward.
Yes.
Which is the best case scenario?
Yeah, the best case scenario is lessons are learned and more work is done to make sure that these victims and their alleged perpetrators go to prison and spend a lot of time in prison.
Absolutely. What would you say some of the shortcomings that you've seen from the report says about the wider party organisation as well? Can we take what we've seen as some of the shortcomings here and see what it says about the broader party organisation, where it can improve, where it's got shortcomings, or we can go further into some of the other criticisms that you've got?
Right,
the paper.
Okay. I'm not convinced from reading the report that it was just edited by the lads at Restore. First of all, I'll get this out there now. If it's being labelled and described as an independent inquiry, Harrison Pitt, Charlie Downs and Josh Firm should not have been editing the report as employees of Restore Britain, as a political party. They shouldn't have been editing it.
Because that by definition is not independent.
Yes. But
so should that have been just outsourced to an
independent? That should have been outsourced either to a lawyer or someone independent. Should have been ideally paid, because when you pay people, you get better work. Paid to edit it. And I don't know to what extent their role was limited to just editing it, because the report itself is, especially on its recommendations, is incredibly vague, and it doesn't engage with the topic in much detail.
Yeah, in your written work, I noticed that this was a consistent complaint, which was that there was just a lack of specificity in anything. It was saying we should do something about X piece of legislation. We should do something about Y piece of legislation, without going into any detail of what something should be.
Yes. And from reading the legal analysis section, it did seem that there wasn't a deep, strong understanding of the current criminal justice system. And again, that's because the person, the lawyer writing it, is not a criminal barrister,
He's writing outside of his area of expertise.
Yes, yeah. Which is what happens, in my opinion, when you don't pay people. Because it's great that people will volunteer their time and help out in any way they can. But if they're not an expert in particular fields, like the legal recommendations, because it's mostly an area of criminal law and also NHS procedure in local government for dealing with vulnerable children, really that aspect of the report should have used consultants And I'm not saying this would have been an easy thing to do, because I would imagine that you may have had people reluctant to get involved in this because it's not a government inquiry and it's done by arguably controversial politician and his organisation, which was a pressure group and then turned into a party.
Yeah, there are any number of factors making this a difficult subject to tackle, particularly given the circumstances. It's a motive, politically charged, political party involvement, any number of things.
Yes. And when I was reading, especially the legality section, I'm like, if the report was written by the lawyer, Graham Smith, I believe his name was, and it was just edited by the lads at Restore, I think not enough time was spent on writing it as should have been. And I do think it is a problem that you had a general lawyer doing it, writing the report, and from what I can tell from publicly available information, there wasn't any support in understanding areas of criminal law. So there are some suggestions that are made as to how criminal law should be amended, but through reading them, it's unclear what of the suggestions that have been made are actually already the case. So one that sticks out to me was the reasonable adjustments for giving evidence. In the report, it just seemed to me that there wasn't as strong of an understanding of how victims of grooming gangs should be entitled under current law anyway to reasonable adjustments, such as giving evidence behind a screen or that type of thing. And the legal part and the report generally was quite vague, and it just doesn't read like someone who has specific knowledge of that area.
Mm. Well, with regards to the overall presentation of the report, what do you think of the decision to do things like include Albert Einstein and Nietzsche quotes?
It's just not appropriate, is it? It's not what you should be doing in a serious independent inquiry.
This is a worry that I had. Would you say that the paper had something more of a polemical tone,
yes,
than that of a neutral and objective inquiry?
Yes.
And this was a worry that I had, was that it had so much hype about it and it had so much excitement going on it, but the polemical tone, the issues that you and others have identified, the use of quotes, it seemed more like, I hate to say this because it seems somewhat dismissive, and I really don't want to be dismissive of such a serious subject, but the shortcomings are forcing me to. It seemed more like a polemical stunt to be used for engagement through people like Elon Musk, and it can raise awareness of this subject, but I think a lot of people are already well aware of this subject by this point. We're no longer in the early to mid 2000s when we were at peak blackout
on this topic.
On this topic, everybody's well aware. The people who are going to listen have listened. The people who are going to stick their head in the sand have stuck their head in the sand. What needs to move forward right now is hopefully with private prosecutions, but more broadly, the people who facilitated this and committed these awful crimes need to be held to account.
Yes.
And I didn't see exactly, without presenting the new information, without coming with new findings and new conclusions, how this report actually helped us get closer to that.
I don't think it did. I actually think that it's worse than that. It's hindered it.
How so?
Because for all the reasons mentioned, the report was very inadequate, and it gives people ammunition who have false pretenses, or to say in a political sense, this issue is being pushed by the right because they're racist, because they don't like Pakistanis. And the tone of the report, I wouldn't say it was racist, I'm just saying that because the report has its problems in that it's not particularly heavy in terms of new information, and the people that they were taking evidence from were people like Connor Tomlinson and Ayaan Hirsi Ali, it just seems politically charged. So Connor Tomlinson is actually quite a good investigative journalist.
Hmm.
However...
Not going to disagree with you there.
No, he's good at what he does. However, I don't think it was wise to have Connor Tomlinson, who is friends with Charlie Downs and Harrison Pitt and the Restore team, giving evidence at the inquiry, because it's another thing that seems not to be independent. So if you are the type of person who wants to push the narrative that this is, these people are making it up, or in some cases there are genuine victims, but the ethnic component of this issue is being exaggerated by the right because they're racist, it doesn't help when the report in of itself and the inquiry as well has heavy involvement from political commentators who are, I wouldn't say, I don't want to use the term radical, but are quite controversial or arguably controversial.
Outside of what most people would consider moderate.
Let's say,
people who are considered partisan.
Yes.
I think would be a reasonable way of putting it. Is it not fair to say that any sort of report on this particular subject, though, would inevitably face heavy politicisation from any and all sides? Is it something that's avoidable at all?
No, but what I mean when I say independent is I don't mean it's going to be a neutral issue, because it's not a neutral issue. Particular communities in the UK commit child sexual grooming at rates that are quite frankly ridiculous. And these communities, whether it's because of Islam as a religion or because of criminality more broadly, tolerate it. One thing that the investigation or the inquiry didn't touch was the effect of cousin marriage on these types of crimes, whether both from a genetic point of view and the genetic issues that come with cousin marriage and the further clanification that comes with cousin marriage. If it was done independently by a group of lawyers who no one had ever heard of, who have expertise in this area, it, in my opinion, it would be much harder to frame the rape gang inquiry as a far-right dog whistle or whatever people say.
Well, I mean, I agree... I agree with what you're saying, certainly regarding the clannish nature of it. We've seen it where family members of people who have been convicted and found guilty for these crimes are in the courtroom protesting and chanting against, despite the fact that they knew what was they allegedly knew what was going on and had helped to conceal it as part of the broader communal ties that these communities had. It is, you spoke about Adam Wren earlier. His work with Open Justice, getting some of the court transcripts publicly released, particularly, I believe, the full court transcript that is available on that website so far is the Bradford one.
Yes.
But I've read through a number of the sentencing remarks from the judges regarding Oxford and such. I did a video on it a while back. Was pretty horrifying when you hear the judges speak about just how heavily involved the community was.
Yes.
In this, how these activities were seen as being a sort of thing that you do on the weekend to blow off steam.
Yes.
with your friends and with your cousins and everybody who's defending themselves. Defending each other is a horrifying thing to consider. But so your recommendations, despite it being out your recommendations would be, if something like this were to happen again in the future, would be to pursue it with a more independent set of solicitors and lawyers, involve proper funding for it, so that obviously it was great that they were able to raise money from people who cared about the subject, who cared about the issues, but if they were able to properly pay people for their time in a way that you would expect to be compensated, could have resulted in something much better.
Yes. That said, I do think that it is a huge problem that this was done without statutory powers, because one of the biggest questions that is always going through my head when I hear this stuff is, why on earth are the responsible adults, whether they're social workers, teachers, or care workers, making these types of mistakes?
That's a great question.
I don't buy that it is just them not wanting to be racist. I don't think that's the case. It does seem to be something that's systematically going on. I would be very surprised if there wasn't, in these cases, guidance that had been put in place to allow for or encourage the way that health workers and responsible adults more broadly had acted towards these kids. Because
so you think this could actually be within their own guidance, and this is something that definitely needs invest. Because my suggestion was going to be with Donna Rachel, one of the criticisms that she brought up was the way that the report had used the term county lines. And given that county lines does refer to using basically mules to traffic drugs from counties, obviously there's a heavy criminal gang involvement outside of just the sex crimes as well. There's drug crimes going on. I was wondering if there was something to do with bribery, involvement. I wouldn't be shocked, but you're going even further and saying this might actually be part of how these organisations are structured in the first place.
Yes, because I'm a pro-life activist and I'm quite interested in pro-life issues. One of the things that gets spoken about quite a lot by pro-life advocates is that in the UK, up until fairly recently, you're meant to have two doctors see you and sign off that getting an abortion is in your best interests. And the SPUC and other organisations have constantly documented that that doesn't happen. That because of arguably time pressures, it changed massively with COVID. If you want to get an abortion, what ends up happening is you might see one doctor and another doctor will just sign it off without seeing you, and you'll be rushed through and you won't have adequate assessments. I would be interested to know whether a similar thing is going on, whereby are there procedures that are being followed that are meant to safeguard these kids, or are they not being followed? Because everyone I know who works with vulnerable children, I know one, two people, and the way they talk about it is there are some very strict procedures that must be followed. And the question I would have that this report doesn't answer is, what is there systematic just rejection of safeguarding procedures by local councils, by teachers? And if not, is there a problem with the guidance itself that it allows for these children who are vulnerable to be failed in this way? I mean, another thing that I've noticed is dealing with vulnerable people is extremely difficult, because people who are genuinely vulnerable are often not very nice to work with, and they have very particular needs that will make them often act in a way that is quite hostile to those who are responsible for them.
A number of women that I know have worked in the care sector, and it's very, very difficult. And you do hear some horror stories of how the people they're caring for behave towards them.
Yeah. Is it that there is something going on whereby the carers just don't have the training and don't have the selection criteria to be able to deal with these victims who, from reading their accounts, they've normally got multiple drug problems, they're normally severe mental health disorders that mean that these children just get lost in the cracks? And a lot of those questions that we've spent the past sort of 10 minutes talking about weren't really addressed, and I think that's a mistake. And I don't actually think a public inquiry would really solve this. I think
it would have to be statutory at that level.
It would have to be statutory, and I think it would be better to do it as a private inquiry, because private inquiries are cheaper, but statutory private inquiries also have statutory powers, they're cheaper, and you normally will send in an appointed lawyer, normally, or other professional to review what they want reviewing.
And who would have the power to launch something like that?
The government.
Just the government?
Yes. I mean, I was in charge, given Lord Protector of the Realm, I would get a whole team of people together who would be placed inside of every local authority this has happened, and they would go through with a fine-tooth comb everything that has gone on and discuss and investigate the reasons. And anybody who had committed a crime through neglecting these kids or taking bribes, as you suggested, may have been the case, I would want them put in prison, because that's the only way of dealing with this.
Yes, absolutely. There needs to be repercussions for this kind of behaviour and higher... forcing people to understand that these are the standards, you adhere to them.
They exist for a reason.
They exist for a reason, and you will be adequately punished.
If not. Yes. Because the most horrible thing about this is that lots of these children, this was something I noticed when I was reading there, had been failed by basically every responsible adult. In some cases, they'd even been raped by their stepdad in one or two cases, and it's just disgusting.
Yeah, these girls are vulnerable for a reason, and it's not started with the gangs, it started at home, then through the care system, and then they've just been failed at every step of their lives, and it's just sort of the culmination of all of that building up. It's easy to see why it's so emotive, and I can truly understand with Restore the motivation, the desire to try to do something about it. But what we're talking about right now is constructive in, if you do want to do something about it,
yes,
you want to focus your attention in ways that is going to be more productive in the end, and make it so that, sadly, the report for a lot of people is just something that got lost in the mix after a while. People got their engagement from tweeting, going, look at this particularly horrible paragraph I found in the testimony. People got their engagement from going like, oh, look at this recommendation they've got here. We need to do this. And then people have moved past it. And
yeah,
it's not made the lasting impact that you would hope something that would like this would have. Hopefully we could see some private prosecutions in the future. I've personally not heard of any.
I think the inquiry in itself, because it didn't have such prowess, it wasn't as effective as it could have been. If I was making the decision, I would have gone for the more starting off with public-private prosecutions and getting as much compensation for the victims, and maybe lobbying for changes to make it more easy for victims to get compensation.
At the time of recording, the most recent development that I've seen regarding Restore was the reaching out of Rupert to offer a joiner between Restore and Reform, which I've seen a lot of people getting very hyped about. I've seen a lot of people getting very excited about. By the time this video has been edited and published, you'll be able to see what this ended up being, if it went nowhere, if it ended up actually doing something. But I've sat here right now, I can't help but feel that this, like a lot of the other stuff that they've been doing recently, feels more like a political stunt
yes.
for the base rather than a serious political maneuver. It feels like them trying to get a gotcha on Reform, so that when Reform say, you stand in the same area as us, you're splitting the vote, they can say afterwards, if they reject it, well, haha, you rejected a joiner with us, therefore you've only got yourselves to blame. What are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are slightly different. The impression that I got from that is Restore Britain is and especially maybe some people in the party, or especially running it, are regretting the move to run and build a national political party by 2029, because it's very expensive. It requires lots of hard work. So one of the reasons that's been floated to me why they keep running in elections that they're not going to win is to build the data so they can map out where their likely voters are and canvass them over the next few years, so that they can turn non-voters or Reform voters into Restore voters, so they can get some more seats.
So it's kind of just a fact-finding mission at the moment.
Yes,
then.
And it's expensive and hard to do that. And if that's what Restore are going to spend the next 2026, 3 years doing until the next election, I think what's going to happen is they're activist base is probably going to decline
Would people lose enthusiasm after engaging in too many
canvassing sessions?
Yeah.
It's incredibly boring.
Well, I went out when during Makerfield, I went out with some of the canvassers, and they were all, to a T, very kind and enthusiastic people, and I really respected their conviction and what they were doing. But I can imagine that if you start to do that on a more regular basis, it could get boring. But some people really loved that process of going to the door and engaging with somebody and speaking to them.
Maybe I'm wrong. And arguably, it's probably a good thing that I'm wrong, certainly for the nativist cause.
And you want people to maintain enthusiasm when it comes to something as important as demographic stability in your homeland.
Yes.
And I hope that certainly people can maintain that same level of enthusiasm. But I see that you wanted to talk about the issue of pubs and policy papers as well.
Yes.
Would you like to tell us about what you think of Restore's policy papers and their current stance on Britain's pubs?
Right. So I'll start with the pubs policy paper because I'm, for the sake of balance, I tried to come up with two or three policy papers that I liked and thought were very good. And the first one of those is the pubs.
Well, we all love a good pub.
Yeah, so we love pubs.
Of course, that's the first thing that an Englishman is going to put the most care into. How can we look after the pubs?
Yes, exactly. And what I loved about this policy paper was that it was concise and it also was very well researched. They'd come up with some really sensible, achievable solutions to improve the lot of pubs, so less of them close each year and maybe there are more pubs. And I've got them noted here. So there's, in the policy paper, they propose reducing business rates, reducing the VAT on hospitality sales to 12.5% and other minor tax changes that, for the sake of time, I won't go into. Read the report or the policy paper itself. It's very good. And the second policy paper that I thought was good, though I had more criticisms of it and maybe some academic disagreements, was the mass deportations one.
Mm.
The way that
was the kind of like centerpiece. This is the policy paper we're going to advertise ourselves off of.
Yes. I liked the structure of it. Legality, logistics, and legitimacy.
Oh, yes.
Yes. I like the approach of talking about law first, because a lot of the problem with dealing with not being able to deport people who are in the UK legally is because of the law and the process. The changes that are suggested by Harris and Pitt in that are great, though I have my disagreements with some of them. For example, I don't necessarily agree that it's worth leaving the ECHR. I'm more in favour of...
Yeah, we discussed this in our last conversation, that it's more of a distraction than it needs to be. You could simply bypass it. If you were in power, of course.
In terms of what I think of Restore's policy papers more generally, there are a few problems that are somewhat reoccurring in that they're too ambitious with things they want to write policy on.
Hmm. I've seen you speak with Alex Masters, who's also been on the show before. Shout out to Alex. About their energy paper, and I saw you were both critical of the energy policy paper that they presented as well.
Yes. The main thing with that is I think that it's a problem because writing an energy paper is extremely difficult.
It's huge, for one. Didn't Alex say it was more like an electricity paper?
Yes.
Because it only really focused on production of electricity rather than all of the other sectors.
Yes.
So that's a case right there, like you were saying, of just over-ambition, not realising the huge scale of what you're supposed to be addressing there.
If I was got told that I needed to write a policy paper on energy and what's our policy towards energy, I would have turned around and said, yeah, give me 10 years and this amount of money. Because
I think that would be a reasonable thing to expect as well.
Yes. So what I would have done is I'd have started by going over the getting rid of net zero, phasing out net zero. And that in of itself is quite difficult. The report undersold that. It framed getting rid of net zero as just oh, repealing the 2008 Climate Change Act. There's other legislation. Because net zero has been so ingrained in British legislation for the past...
almost 20 years, yeah. If you're going back only to 2008.
Longer, because before the Paris Agreement and various other agreements, and that legislation was passed, it's also been put into planning in law and other areas of the law that are quite difficult and complicated. Because, so, for, I don't know, let's say 30 years, planning law has had to have a net zero component to it, so has investment and basically every other area of the economy. And that's what the climate change...
So it's just completely baked in?
Yeah, it's completely baked in. You would... I've got in my notes a list of legislation that the Prosperity Institute put together on what legislation they would want to amend, and I'll send it to you and you can put it up when,
yes, when
we're done,
yeah,
or
yeah.
Leave in the description, because it's quite a long list. Because it's net zero, if you want to get rid of it, you're going to have to make drastic changes to planning and basically every other area of the British economy and British legislation. And it's not an easy thing to do. You could have written a 100-page policy paper on how to get rid of net zero.
And that probably wouldn't have been enough by itself at 100 pages.
Probably not.
Yeah, I mean, there are books, and there are dozens of books written about net zero, dozens of papers probably already written about net zero at this point, all going into extravagant detail on it. So just having, as you say, a short section addressing it was not adequate.
And
no. Something else that I noticed that you said, this is going back to the inquiry report as well, seems to be it was written in a similar polemical tone.
Yes, it was.
Which seems to be a consistent feature of some of the papers that they put out.
I think the problem with this is I don't think Harrison Pitt, who writes most of this stuff, is able to write in anything other than a polemical tone, because though he's had policy roles at the New Culture Forum, as far as I can tell from looking at his CV, he's not really a policy professional in the same way that you would expect. He's a political commentator, first of all, who's had some policy role at the New Culture Forum, which in of itself, it's not like the Tony Blair Institute or the Centre for Social Justice. It's not something that discusses policy for that they actually think is going to be implemented. And it's mainly focused on culture and preserving the institutions. It's not something that would have given him expertise in things like energy or the ability to know where to start with the energy paper. So going to the energy paper, on my notes, there's a lot of things that weren't included that should have been, especially on the nuclear section. So in 2025, there was a regulatory review conducted by, or led by, John Fingleton. And this wasn't mentioned by Restore. And what the regulatory report or investigation conducted by him and his team, it came up with 47 recommendations, which were things like streamlining the regulatory process. So for nuclear regulation specifically, one of the reasons why it's so expensive to build nuclear reactors in the UK is because you have so many different regulators that you have to deal with separately. And at each stage and each regulator you're dealing with, you can enter into a prolonged legal battle over whether or not it can go ahead or whether something should need to satisfy.
And obviously that's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah. So you might have a budget of, or get quoted, $10 billion to build a nuclear reactor, but or a nuclear power station. But because of planning, because of the licensing and this, that and the other, everything else that's going on, you can end up with something that's meant to cost $10 billion being a 10-year project, being a 20 or 30-year project and costing obscene amounts more.
Is this anything to do with why HS2?
Yes.
Has taken so long, just all of these regulatory minefields that you end up on?
Yes, it is. It's planning. So in academic circles that deal with things like public policy and law, there has been an outcry for planning reform and it's ongoing.
Would this be a process of reforming it through streamlining? If there's
streamlining it mostly. So this report I've just mentioned, it advocates streamlining the planning and the regulatory process for nuclear projects specifically, but you will find other reports in different areas, whether it's housing, saying, no, the planning process needs to be streamlined and it because it's so unpredictable.
Mm.
Because you, especially for something like building a house, which is simpler to do, planning permission might take 6 months. It might take 2 years and you don't know. So there wasn't really much of a mention in terms of the energy report. And this is what I really didn't like, is there wasn't any interaction really with the other academic works that have been done. And this is a problem that is somewhat systematic of their policy papers. So the example
you could say it's systematic of some of the work that's done on the right in general.
Yes.
A lot of people who exist within the commentary space, I include myself in this, I'm not innocent, are not aware that this work has been done or where to find it if they want to even find it in the first place.
Yeah.
Which is where, you know, enterprising people like yourself are useful in being able to point us in the right direction and help to guide this rather than people just going at it blindfolded.
I can certainly understand why someone like Harrison Pitt, with his background, is not going to be able to write an energy policy paper on his own. He's not going to know what the literature is that he should be reading.
You mentioned Harrison as though he wrote it all himself. Was there any acknowledgement from other people writing that paper?
From what he said publicly, and I can't remember the exact acknowledgements, it was mostly written by him, and there are other people who have been referenced in the report, and there are acknowledgements. The way that he described it on his interview with Dan was he was helped a little bit in terms of where to look. That was the impression that I got from what he said.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just nothing. It doesn't seem like he had a large amount of support to be able to write this policy paper, which if you'd have said to me, can you write a policy paper on energy? I'd have said no. We'll split it up into multiple papers that are written in part, in various parts of them, by consultants who have certain expertise. So one of the criticisms I made was in the fracking section of the energy report, they reference, I believe the phraseology is something like, we were told by this person about who has expertise in fracking about how unreasonable the fracking licensing is and the health and safety for it is.
That seems somewhat insubstantive.
Yes, but my point when I read that and put in my article where I reviewed this policy paper was, why didn't you get that guy to write the fracking section? Like, pay him to do it?
Yeah.
Because this is how really well-drafted policy actually should be getting done on the right. Because most policy, as far as I can tell from my observations, will start its life with a think tank or some academic, and then it will get drafted into a policy paper. And then what will happen is it will be approved by government or pushed on government. Government will either make any legislative changes or tell the civil service to enact this policy, and the civil service will build up what that policy idea looks like in practice. On the right, you don't actually have that option, because if you did have a right-wing party such as Restore going into government, you'd be going into a hostile environment whereby the civil service, you couldn't expect them to write policy in line with your wishes. So you can't go in there with vague policy ideas. You'd have to go in there with well-drafted policy papers, legislative changes.
Almost step by step.
Step by step, yeah. You would have to go in with that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, this isn't to denigrate Harrison. He's a smart guy. He's a very intelligent guy, very insightful guy. But you are right. I mean, if, for instance, I was asked, are you capable of writing a paper like this? I'd say no.
No.
No? I mean, why would you think that I am? But that's not to insult Harrison. That's the constructive criticism.
Yes.
That you should be going to these consultants who are the people that you're consulting. and paying them to write up those whole sections if they are experts
in
that field in the first place.
For example, my stream with Alex Masters was with a guy called ARG, that's his anon name. Mm-hmm. The guy's a nuclear engineer.
So pretty well informed.
Pretty well versed,
yes.
So this was a criticism that he made as well, that in the part of the energy policy paper that discusses the reforms to nuclear energy policy, there weren't any specifics. Like, there was regulations, we will deregulate, without saying what it is. And there was no mention of this paper that I mentioned, the 2025 regulatory review that was conducted by the guy with the impronounceable surname.
Well, if Finkleton sounds about right.
Yes, Mr. Finkleton. And that's quite a detailed paper. I skimmed through it and read its recommendations. And that's something that could have been included. So, and they didn't really reference it at all, certainly not in any kind of detail. And that would have been a really good place to start.
Absolutely. Well, we're coming to time now.
Yeah.
We're almost when we need to end. So just to sum up our conversation, what would you say, very succinctly, the positives, the negatives, and the constructive places that they should go moving forward for Restore?
Right. So I think Restore, in terms of policy, needs to get used to the idea that Harrison isn't going to be able to write all their policy papers, or most of them. But what he can do is, because he's very intelligent, decide what a policy paper is going to be written on, whether it's energy, whether it's infrastructure, and find people who know enough about the topic to say to them, right, we would like you to write this part of a policy paper. We're coming together on, I don't know, farming, go to someone in the farmers union. And then when you've got individual bits of a policy paper, amend them so they're in line with the priorities of Restore. For example, the Prosperity Institute, they did an energy paper a few months ago. And what they did a good job of was it was a 30-page policy paper on energy, but it was mainly focused around changing a load of legislation on net zero. And one of the main recommendations was separate net zero targets from energy, because right now they're linked, which is why energy is so expensive in the UK. And I think they need to get better at, especially the Restore team, going, okay, if this is what we want as a policy paper, we need to delegate this, most of this, at the drafting stage, to people who are consultants, who know the area, who in some cases, in the case of the Farmers Union, they might do it for free. But other people, you probably would need to pay to get high quality work. And that's the main sort of takeaway. I think Restore needs to, especially the policy team, needs to understand that you can't, even if you're the smartest person in the world, you're not going to be able to come up with policy that is effective and sensible on your own. And you need to build a network of people who maybe they're consultants, maybe they're unions, maybe they're people that you meet in academic conferences who you can delegate the job of writing particular parts of a policy paper and spend your time interrogating it and aligning those parts of the policy paper together to create coherent policy.
Well, perhaps with these recent developments with extending the hand to reform, maybe that's the sort of infrastructure that we'll see built. So some constructive points there. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation, folks. I am still broadly rooting for Restore because ultimately they do have good people within the party. They are the only party that is able to, at the moment, serve as a vehicle for the nativist cause in England. But there are a lot of problems that have become very apparent since they became a party that really need cleaning up.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining me, Henry. Remind everybody where they can find you.
On X, I'm at Law Reading, Substack Reactionary Reading Law, and that's about it.
Well, you can find him all of those places. Thank you again for joining me. Pick up his book. It's available on Amazon and other retailers. And we'll see you next time. Take care.